It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, co-host of The World. We're dropping a special series into our feed today. It's about the Kurdish community in Nashville, the largest in the U.S. The show, The Country in Our Hearts, tells the story of how that came to be. It's from WPLN, Nashville Public Radio. Host and reporter Rose Gilbert takes you on a journey from Nashville all the way to northern Iraq and back again, tracing the story of one Kurdish family and their generations-long fight to exist. It is 4 episodes. This is episode 3.
It's my final night in Çalke. Tomorrow, Aran and I will leave the village and return to the city of Duhok, an hour and a half south. But there's one more place to visit before we go.
Yeah, thank you.
The cemetery. Aran, Haleen, her mother, a handful of the older aunts, everyone washes and dresses for evening prayers and then bundles into cars. As we drive out of the village, Haleen hands me a purple scarf and shows me how to cover my hair and neck.
Make it longer on the right side.
Longer on the right side?
Yeah, are you right-handed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Like this.
Çalke Cemetery sits on the outskirts of the village, on a hillside of long yellow grass and twisting trees. As we pick our way through the headstones, Haleen and the other women begin to weep silently. As the ladies pray, Aran points out his relatives' resting places.
My mom's, my dad's mom. That's my dad.
Some, he says, died in America, but had their bodies sent back to be buried in Çalke.
It's my uncle's wife. That's his sister right above him. So this whole area. This is her mom.
I can't read the names or epitaphs, which are all written in Kurdish. But his father's headstone, with green marble and gold lettering, it stands out immediately.
So his name was Naif Ibrahim Numan Çalke, but he was known by Said Naif.
Aran tells me he tries to visit the grave whenever he comes back to Çalke.
And each time I've came down to the village, I've been tied up or I've had guests, and just the timing.
He has so many obligations now. Family to visit, business to oversee, not to mention working on the new house he's building. Said Naif died in 2013. It was sudden, unexpected, a massive heart attack at just 57 years old. And it was a huge blow for Aran.
You know, he was my role model. He was my superhero.
How does it feel, you know, in some way stepping into that legacy, trying to uphold that? After his passing in his memory.
He knew the culture, he knew the people, he saw the struggle. So to try to fill his shoes would be, I won't say a burden, but a heavy, heavy load to carry.
I can tell from my time with Aran that his father follows him everywhere. His stories, his accomplishments, his old sayings.
I remember what he used to always say. He used to say, your reputation is priceless, you know? So you try not to break it.
They were prescient words, words that today Aran lives by. But he didn't always. Aran came of age in America at a tumultuous time in the nation's history, filled with terrorism, war, and so much fear. All the while, he was straddling two countries and two cultures. This pulled at Aran's identity. On one side was his father's legacy and his family's sacrifices. On the other was life in America, unknown and uncharted, leaving Aran in a sort of no man's land. As he grew up, these two forces pulled at him harder and harder until they began to break him and his reputation in two. I'm Rose Gilbert, and from Nashville Public Radio, you're listening to The Country in Our Hearts. This is episode 3, Safety Zone.
I remember riding this bike, the small little red bike that I owned. It was the first couple of years in Nashville.
This is Aran's very first memory.
I was probably like five, six.
He remembers riding down the steep hill near his house, the rush of it.
And I think just that hill was probably started a lot for me.
The exhilaration of doing something a little bit dangerous.
I'm not an adrenaline junkie, but I do like to try things, you know.
Aran was born in a Turkish refugee camp and was still a baby when his family came to America. First to Texas, then to Tennessee, where dozens of other Chalkiv families had resettled. They packed up their apartment in Fort Worth and moved into a modest three-bedroom ranch home on the south side of Nashville.
It had a big tree in the front, and it had the brick wraparound driveway, you can't miss it.
Aran tells me more than 20 Kurdish families lived nearby, including plenty of family. As kids, they spent a lot of time at the neighborhood playground, playing soccer, basketball, and hojone, a version of hide-and-seek. He and his siblings went to local public schools with kids from all over the globe. Aran loved it.
I didn't feel being a different race in America. I always felt American.
Every so often, cultural differences did emerge. Like during Ramadan, when his classmates would pepper him with questions.
Whoa, you mean you can't eat for the whole month? And then you would have to, you know, explain to him, like, no, sun up to sun down.
But those differences never made him feel alienated.
I remember during lunch, our friends, like, they would not want to eat in front of us. There was still an understanding, like, hey, my friend can't eat, you know? Or sometimes, let's say they'll pop a soda or something and drink it, but, oh, sorry, man, I forgot, I can't drink in front of you.
Aran says he didn't think much about his heritage or about Kurdistan. It was his family's homeland, but he was born after they left. He had never even laid eyes on it. That all changed in 1999.
That trip changed my whole perspective it changed my identity, I would say.
When he was about 9 years old, Aran flew to Turkey with his mother and brother. His father met them at the airport and drove them over the mountains and into Iraqi Kurdistan, a reversal of the route they took when they fled in 1988. Aran remembers staring out the car window, searching the unfamiliar mountains for answers.
But I remember I was looking around like, you know, no, I'm from there, you know?
Everything was new to him. The villages, the rough roads, the frequent power outages.
That's where everything started. Like, boom, then I started questioning, hold on, I thought I was from America.
He got to see his dad in his element as a Peshmerga general.
Yeah, I remember my first time going to the military base. With him.
Aran's mom had packed him an outfit to wear for the occasion. A set of miniature soldier's fatigues with an orange safety vest.
The respect he got, you know, opening his door. And, you know, once he comes into the room, everybody stands up. And, you know, the salute. And I was like, I was kind of starstruck.
As the general's son, that special treatment extended to Aran. When he asked for water, grown men rushed to get him a glass. And when he visited Chalkiv for the first time, there was a crowd of people waiting for his father outside.
I remember just looking up at him like, okay, this is who my dad is. Wow, I felt it was larger than life feeling, to be honest.
Aran had grown up on stories about his father. Seeing him here in the seat of his power, Aran had more questions than ever.
And then you become curious and you start asking, okay, well, dad, who are you? What are you? What are we?
When Aran came back to Nashville, he felt changed in some fundamental way.
And I really put a lot of emphasis on, okay, am I American Kurd or am I Kurdish American?
Kurdistan was no longer some abstract place. It was his heritage, his homeland, a place where his family was celebrated.
Maybe I'm not a regular kid here, you know? Maybe I am blessed with something.
Like, you're Aran here, and there you're the general's son.
Exactly.
He came home to Nashville with this new, burning interest in all things Kurdish. At lunch, he told his school friends about Halabja and Saddam Hussein and his father, the general. He was American, but he wasn't only American. Then it happened.
We heard this loud thunder. We looked up, and the top of the half of the building was actually coming down like dominoes, and it just fell over to the left, and that was it.
September 11th, 2001.
People still jumping out the windows right there. Still jumping out.
Jumping out. There are people jumping out the window.
Aran was 11 years old.
I was in school. I remember the teacher's name, Mr. Chappelle. And I remember it happening and everything stopped and him turning on the TV.
Sitting in class that day, Aran didn't realize the enormity of what had just happened or what the fallout would be. But it seemed his teacher did.
And I remember him explaining to the whole class, like, hey, look, we have people who believe in different religions and you guys are playing, eating, talking, laughing together. And I remember putting so much emphasis on that. I remember that day very, very vividly.
Nearly 3,000 people died in the attacks on September 11th. Thousands more were injured. And in that moment, a connection was formed in the minds of millions of Americans between Islam and terrorism. After class, Aran says the teacher, Mr. Chappelle, pulled him and the other Muslim students aside to assure them he had their back. At the time, Aran didn't understand what his teacher was so worried about.
But it was like a month or so afterwards, maybe more. I remember one night in Kroger.
He was on a late-night grocery run with his mom, a religious woman who has worn a hijab most of her life. As they went to check out, Aran says a stranger came up to them and started yelling.
That lady was like, oh, you know, you're a terrorist. Why don't you take off your hijab, da-da-da, go back to where you're from. And my mom, she could speak English, but not very fluently. But before she could even respond, there was people there. There was, you know, Americans there to defend her, like, you know. And then, boom, it hit me like, okay, this is what Mr. Chappelle was talking about.
Aran tells me the other shoppers rallied to defend them and escorted the woman out of the store.
That's where Polly hit me like, should we go back home? Should we go to Kurdistan?
On the drive home from the store, Aran says his mom tried to brush it off.
Mom kept reassuring me, it's okay. But I remember telling her, like, should we just go back home to see Dad?
He remembers seeing the fear in her eyes and wondering, what if this happened again?
You know, what if nobody's there to help defend her, right? What if there is a group? What if next time it's a man who's just ticked off?
Aran realized that, yet again, his family could become an internal threat. This time, not because they were Kurdish, but because they were Muslim. The week after 9/11, Friday prayers at the Salahuddin Center, Nashville's Kurdish mosque, were half empty. Community leaders started telling hijabi women, like Aran's mom, to avoid going out alone or to consider leaving their scarves at home. People were scared.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps.
Less than a month after the attacks, the United States embarked on a war in Afghanistan.
Today we focus on Afghanistan, but the battle is broader.
A little over a year later, America turned its attention to Saddam Hussein and that now infamous phrase.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Atomic weapons of mass destruction.
About weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Developing weapons of mass destruction.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
In February 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell went before the United Nations Security Council to make the case for war on Iraq and Saddam Hussein.
Most damning of all, his utter contempt for human life.
In that speech, he cited his crimes against the Kurds, Halabja, Al-Anfal.
Saddam Hussein's use of mustard and nerve gas against the Kurds in 1988. 1988 was one of the 20th century's most horrible atrocities.
And then he claimed that Iraq was harboring terrorists linked to the 9/11 attacks.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources.
And as we know, he said Saddam Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction.
These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
We know now that intelligence never materialized. There were no WMDs, no real connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. But regardless, the U.S. barreled toward war. A war that many Americans and the world didn't want.
No war on Iraq! No war on Iraq!
As many as 10 million people from across 60 countries took to the streets in protest. The largest anti-war demonstration in recorded history. Meanwhile, in northern Iraq, the Kurds braced for devastation. Fearing a chemical attack, people fled the major cities en masse, creating desperate, gridlock traffic. People sealed their doors and windows with plastic wrap and cobbled together homemade gas masks from diapers and charcoal. In Nashville, Adan's family could only watch and wait.
The news was constantly on at my house.
He says CNN played on the living room TV 24/7.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
And I remember sitting down in my front on the couch when Bush declared a war on Iraq.
These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
The Kurds in the north feared these rising tensions would trigger another Halabja. So when the United States invaded Iraq from the south, it was a relief.
So you're overwhelmed with this sense of like, yes, right, this happiness. But then, you know, it's like, oh, but my dad's going back to war.
The American military had a natural ally in the Kurdish Peshmerga, a fighting force of about 100,000, all with good reason to want Saddam Hussein gone. Aran says his father was stationed in Mosul, where Peshmerga and U.S. Special Forces won several decisive victories. U.S. forces swiftly took Baghdad, and then, several months later, took Saddam Hussein into custody.
And I remember being so, so happy and prideful that, like, it happened in my lifetime.
In many parts of the world, America included, the Iraq War is widely regarded as an expensive disaster, a stain on the United States' global reputation. But for the Kurds, it ended the brutal Ba'athist regime. And with that came relief, revenge, and a shot at independence. For Iran, it was a culmination.
Everything that my dad has stood up for or fought for is paid off. We're going to become a country.
The United States oversaw new elections where a prominent Kurdish leader was elected president of Iraq. A new constitution was crafted, one that officially recognized an autonomous Kurdish region in northern Iraq. Aran watched on from Nashville, knowing that his family, his father, had helped make it all possible.
And then I remember walking so pridefully amongst that because it's like, okay, Saddam got toppled and your dad's a part of the war, a figure that's known. And then you're like, ah, you're ecstatic. Yeah, words can't explain, honestly.
It was an immense reversal of fortunes. After decades of failed rebellions and displacement and genocide, the Kurds were calling the shots in Iraq, backed up by their American allies. When Saddam Hussein was executed in 2006, Iraqi state TV broadcast the event.
People were having, like, live barbecue. I mean, it was, hey, today's the execution, dude. You know, let's get together and celebrate.
It was a happy day for Nashville's Kurdish community.
People were dancing. I remember having this feeling of joy, to be honest. Okay, our oppressor is finally gone. Maybe did he get what he deserved, right?
I can tell Aran feels conflicted about cheering someone's death, anyone's death. But Saddam was the villain of his family's story, the reason they fled Chalke, the reason why his father was still in Kurdistan while Iran was in America, trying his best to navigate the world of a first-generation Kurdish-American teenager. And in that world, something new was forming, something that threatened to destroy the reputation that Iran, his family, and his community had worked so hard to build. More after the break. What I'm going to talk about next is a sensitive topic in Nashville's Kurdish community, something most people would prefer not to talk about, to leave in the past. But this is a podcast about history, including its hard, complicated chapters. And for better or for worse, this chapter is part of the history of this community and this city. They called themselves the Kurdish Pride Gang, or KPG. Their color was a bright yellow, taken from the iconic blazing sun on the center of the Kurdish flag. They weren't really on anyone's radar, not the police's and not even their own parents. Until 2006, when a few members shot at a cop during a drug robbery gone wrong. That got everyone's attention quickly, including the national media.
Today, we take you to Tennessee. Police officials have linked a rash of brutal crimes in Nashville to a Kurdish youth street gang. The revelation has...
The group stood accused of some very serious crimes. Drug dealing, beatings, rape, murder. Eventually, the city would even file a lawsuit, the first of its kind, to ban the group from a couple of local parks. I knew about the KPG when I started this project, but what I didn't know was that police claimed Aran was a member. Aran had never volunteered this information while we were traveling together in Kurdistan, but when I got home, I started looking deeper into the KPG, and I saw Aran's name come up in the court records. I realized that he clearly had another story to tell.
Well, now I want to talk about something. This is a little sensitive, okay? So I want you to be ready for that.
So months after returning from Kurdistan, I set up a Zoom meeting to broach the topic.
I want to talk about the Kurdish Pride Gang.
Okay. It was more of, it was Kurds, minority, growing up, and obviously in America.
I can tell by his tone he's caught off guard, but he tries to explain.
You know, this is a way of keeping our pride intact, keeping our defending each other. So, you know, let us Kurds become one.
What did they feel they had to defend themselves from?
We have strength in numbers. This is a way for us Kurds to stay united, to defend each other, let's say, from the next gang or the next group.
Aran and his family arrived in Nashville in the 1990s as part of a wave of Kurdish refugees, which coincided with the war on drugs and the rise of American gang culture. These families settled here and enrolled their kids in public schools. And it was there, Aran says, where they ran into pre-existing gangs, competing groups with their own colors and codes, and they decided to join in.
Other people have their gangs, so why shouldn't we?
Exactly. Ours?
It was part of a bigger pattern in immigrant groups across the nation who formed their own cliques. In Nashville, it wasn't just the KPG. There was also the Asian Pride Gang and the Mexican-American Brown Pride Gang.
And then, you know, something small just grew bigger and bigger, right?
Members of the Kurdish Pride Gang have been linked to serious, violent crimes. But the KPG, as a phenomenon, extended far beyond them. The Kurdish community was tight-knit, and a lot of kids had close ties to the KPG, even if they weren't actively part of the gang themselves.
A lot of us were relatives. We were cousins. Many of them were probably brothers. It's deeper than a gang, right? It's family.
Aran tells me he was never officially a member of the KPG, despite what police claim.
Yeah. I mean, I was never fully associated. I never got jumped in, never this, never that. But I think what happened was it was like those rebel years.
But in 2009, Aran started getting into some real trouble. First, for trespassing.
Oh, okay. See, it goes back to, I'm telling you, this wrong place at the wrong time.
Aran says he was taking a shortcut through an apartment complex on his way to hang out with his cousin at a nearby park when...
There's cops circling, and then boom, I just get stopped. What are you doing here? I'm going to the park.
Aran says the cops were actually looking for his cousin, but he fit the description. He got a misdemeanor trespassing charge and was sentenced to 8 hours of community service, clearing out desks at a local school. From there, things escalate. Aran is caught carrying marijuana and for selling a small amount of cocaine.
It was just some quick cash. I was a good salesman. You know? Because you want the nicer things. You want the nice shoes. You want this. You know, as a young teen. But yeah.
Did you have a pair of shoes you really wanted in particular?
I mean, I got them. Yeah, they were the Jordan 9s, the Space Jams.
That shooting in 2006, it was a turning point. Law enforcement started keeping close tabs on the Kurdish community. Aran says they'd post up at his pickup basketball games,
five or six police cruisers with officers lounging on the hoods, watching them play.
It made you feel like, what the hell is going on?
There was one man in particular that was all over the KPG, a detective for the Nashville gang unit named Mark Anderson.
He made it seem like it was a gang war between us and KPG and them.
When my producer and I started looking into the KPG, Anderson's name was on indictments, evidence logs, witness lists, reports.
Okay. Yeah, Detective Mark Anderson.
Yeah. Mark Anderson. Another Anderson.
Yeah, Anderson.
Mm-hmm. He was all over this.
And when I started making calls to detectives who had worked KPG cases back then, they said the same thing. So I reached out to try and get a police perspective on the KPG, how it operated, and what that moment was like in Nashville's history.
Rose, this is Mark Anderson.
Yes, thank you for giving me a call back. I appreciate it. We talked for a little over 10 minutes, and what I heard surprised me. Anderson's investigation of the KPG had defined his career for years. He won awards for his work and made some major arrests. But now he was adamant that he did not want to talk about it, that it was in the past, and that's where he wanted it to stay. In the end, he did give me a name, Dr. Kurmanj Gundi, a local Kurdish professor. So I made an appointment to meet Dr. Gundi at his office on the campus of Tennessee State University. The walls are covered in posters and paintings. Thank you. There's a Kurdish rug hanging behind his desk.
Handmade. When you're in Kurdistan, you probably have seen a lot of this. You can find this in almost every household.
I asked Dr. Gundi if he had any idea why Anderson didn't want to talk.
Officer Anderson was showing me some messages he was getting from different individuals of Kurdish Pride Gang. Threats with his life, nasty words, using F words. There were a lot of, quite a few of them he showed me.
When the KPG started gaining prominence in the 2000s, Gundi was already an established professor and community leader. Originally from the city of Erbil, or Hawler, as many Kurdish people call it, he was part of the earliest wave of Kurdish immigration to Nashville during the 1970s. His family fled after a failed Kurdish rebellion against Iraq, the same upheaval that forced Nash and his family to leave Çalke when he was a baby, back in 1976. When I asked Gundi about the emergence of the KPG, he called it the darkest day of the Nashville Kurdish community's history.
How can you be proud and defend the Kurdish community by being on the other side, the opposite side of the law?
As a professor, Gundi was a high-profile member of the community, and so he started getting a lot of calls asking him about the KPG. One of them was from Detective Mark Anderson.
We were in communication, close communication, to see what can we do to minimize the damage to our community.
Gundi helped the police build a relationship with the Kurdish community in the attempt to shut down the KPG. But even he didn't realize just how far the gang's reach had spread.
Let me tell you a story.
Gundi had a teenage son of his own. And one day, while eating lunch with Detective Anderson,
I wrote my son's name and put it before them. I said, if the name was familiar to them. And Officer Anderson looked at it and said, he is in our radar.
His son wasn't a member, they said, but he had friends who were. Gundi was shocked. The first chance he got, he took his son downtown to the police station to try and scare him straight.
We went there and they took us to a conference room. And after a few minutes, they came with huge three-ring folders. Each says KPG. They came down hard on my son. They asked him so many questions about who they were, whom did he know about in the KPG gang organization. He did not say a word. He did not give the name of anyone.
Gundi says one of the detectives looked at his son and said,
"What do you all think of yourself? You can fight the United States?" He said, "In 15 minutes, I can bring FBI, TBI, local police, state troopers," and he mentioned all the police forces, "in anywhere I want. Why you think you can fight us?"
The detectives wanted to make something very clear to Gundi's son. America was a force to be reckoned with. And from Gundi's perspective, it worked. He tells me that meeting, quote, "changed my son." Over the next decade, Detective Anderson built cases against dozens of alleged KPG members, including a case against Aran. Here's how it happened. In 2010, Aran sold half a gram of cocaine to someone who turned out to be a confidential informant. Aran had no idea at the time. Then, less than 2 weeks later, he got a weird request from a customer. It was a guy who'd bought marijuana from him once or twice. And now he wanted to buy almost $4,000 worth of cocaine. Aran knew something was off.
"I should have listened to my gut. I knew, I promise you, I knew. I'm not going to say it was a setup, but I knew something was off. So we ended up just putting flour in a bag, and before you know it, it was a CIA agent."
So he and his friend sold the guy 127 grams of flour, unaware that the customer was another undercover informant. Months pass, and Aran travels to Kurdistan to visit his dad. One day, he was out with his friends, playing soccer, when he got a call from his father, telling him to come home now.
And he was just sitting in his office, and he goes, "Hey, is there something you want to tell me?" He goes, "Okay, explain to me, why are the cops at my door in America?" And still, I have no idea.
While he'd been in Kurdistan, Aran had been indicted. And now he had to explain all this to his father.
That was the toughest conversation of my life. Yeah. I remember him just shaking his head because he said, "Isn't this something I begged you guys to stay away from?"
Did you ever consider not coming back, or was that just not an option after you talked to your dad?
I actually did. I told him. I was like, why go back? But he's like, no. He said, "That's not the way I taught y'all. This is something that you did. This is something that you chose. So go deal with it."
And that's exactly what Aran did. He got a lawyer and booked a flight to New York City, where his older brother Nash was waiting to pick him up and drive him back to Tennessee. When they got back to Nashville, Aran first went home to see his family, then to Hooters, where he ate a plate of chicken wings, and finally to the police station to turn himself in. A little while later, Aran says Detective Mark Anderson showed up.
It was like 1, 2 a.m. when I turned myself in. And I remember him walking in and he goes, "Man, you should be honored that I get out of bed from a night's sleep next to my wife to come see you."
I reached out to Detective Anderson to corroborate this account. He didn't respond. Aran took a plea deal, which amounted to a suspended sentence, community service, and a couple $1,000s in fees and fines. But it wasn't the money he was worried about.
Honestly, I was more hurt for my family than myself, because I felt like I let them down, Yeah, I wasn't scared, but I was very angry and disappointed in myself.
Then, some months later, after his case was all wrapped up, the police once again pulled up to his family's home.
I see 4 Chevrolet Tahoes pull up in the driveway. And when that happens, I run to the back door. Because, I don't know. You're scared. Like, what's going on?
As Aran started to make a run for it, he heard his brother open the door. But the officers didn't have a warrant and didn't try to come inside. They weren't there to arrest him. They were there to serve him a civil lawsuit filed by the city of Nashville against the Kurdish Pride Gang. And in that lawsuit, there was a list. The names of 24 Kurdish men who were identified as gang members and banned from 2 local parks. They called this area a safety zone. One of the names on the list was Aran Ibrahim.
The document describes a number of crimes allegedly committed by members of the gang, all centered around these parks. The crimes range from graffiti and drug possession to beatings, shootings, and witness intimidation. Aran is mentioned once. He allegedly purchased a box of ammunition that police found in the possession of a member of the gang. Aran strongly disputes this, saying he never purchased ammunition for anyone in the KPG.
What was going through your mind when you saw your name on that list?
I was shocked, honestly.
Aran says not everyone named in the lawsuit was a gang member.
Or you feel like you just have a target on your back because you look at the list and it's some people in your neighborhood that you grew up with. I'm not trying to justify what I did was right. No, I know what I did was wrong. I know it's a crime. I know it was, you know, something that I wish I can take back. But it doesn't justify me as being a gang member.
After the lawsuit, Aran got caught twice with small amounts of marijuana, including once in the lawsuit's safety zone. He avoided jail time, but got a GPS ankle monitor and supervised probation. He had come back to America to turn himself in and turn a new leaf, but he kept getting into the same kind of trouble. And now his name was on a very public list, identifying him as a member of a dangerous street gang. Then, one day in the spring, he got a call from a cousin to come to his uncle's house right away.
And then when I get to there and I see the house is full of cars and then they broke it down to me like, hey, it's your dad.
His father had died from a heart attack.
You're lost now. Because at the end of the day, you know, like your dad is, he's your backbone. You know, there's a Kurdish saying, we say he's a mountain behind you, right? He's your rock.
His father's death left Aran unmoored. He got special dispensation from the judge to go back to Kurdistan for the funeral. It was a big event, attended by all the soldiers and villagers Aran's father had devoted his life to. And afterwards, Aran made a decision.
I think it's best if I stay here and, you know, I want to work on myself as well. Yeah, it's time for me to grow up. And it's best if I'm away from there, because now that I lose my backbone and my father, what's going to stop me from slipping up again?
He decided to leave Nashville and move to Kurdistan permanently, to be where people knew him not just as Aran, but as the general's son. Sayed Naif's reputation is a heavy thing, but it's also a beacon for Aran.
I have to watch what I do, I have to watch what I say, I have to watch how I interact, because you're looked upon in a certain way, right?
It's been more than a decade since Aran moved back to Kurdistan. And in that time, the Kurdish Pride Gang has all but faded into oblivion. Meanwhile, Aran's taken over where his father left off and built a reputation of his own here.
The worst day of my life probably ended up being the best thing for me.
He's worked with international journalists to share the stories of Yazidi refugees targeted by the terrorist group ISIS. He's built a new home in his family's village in Chulke. He's kept his father's door open and his family's connection to Kurdistan alive.
I hold that with a lot of pride. Yeah, it's a heavy load to carry on your shoulders, but it makes you feel not important, but valuable.
Hearing Aran talk about being proud of his decision, I thought of the cemetery so many months ago, long before I'd seen the lawsuit, before I knew any of this. I remembered the sun setting behind the mountains, the women praying, the crickets singing, the still, sacred evening. And I remembered Aran standing in front of his father's grave.
I think so far, hopefully he'll be proud. Yeah, I think he'll be happy with the decisions I've made so far.
I'd asked him then why he'd given up America to go back to Kurdistan. Now I understood that it was a sacrifice, something Aran did for his family and for his father. But it was more than that. Aran's move to Kurdistan was a choice to grow up and grow beyond the mistakes he'd made in Nashville.
It was a fast decision, but I think it was one that I made for myself.
Next time on the final episode of The Country in Our Hearts, episode 4, the Kurdish American dream.
They would just tell them pretty much like that America is a land of opportunities. There's much you can get from it.
I am worried that if I go to Turkey, first of all, they will put me in jail.
Traffic stops over the weekend led to ICE detainments in Nashville.
These kids will be American. They will be raised here and they will serve the United States.
You know, the tunnel's dark. Kurds have a dark history of, you know, pain and suffering. But there's always light, Nevruz.
The Country in Our Hearts was reported and produced by me, Rose Gilbert. My editor and co-producer was Mariba Knight, who spent a lot of time with me digging through court records. Additional editing by Tony Gonzalez, LaTanya Turner, and Rachel Iacovone, with help from Mariana Bacayao, Char Dastin, and Justin Barney. Mac Limbaugh is Nashville Public Radio's Vice President of Audience and supported this project in many ways. Our community and cultural advisors on this project were Dr. David Romano and Dilman Yassin. Sound design was done by Martin Cruz, fact-checking by Daniel Potter, and original logo artwork is by Naveen Barwadi. Traditional music is by Arkan Doski, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Paul McAdoo, Jennifer Nelson, and Samantha Max.
From PRX.